I told Ben before he delivered the introduction that I just wrote a rather absurd short story called When Introducing Rick Moody. That's a list of all the things that no introducer should ever do. And then I told him I'd give it to him after he gave his introduction. Number 8 on the list is that it's your job to create in the audience the need to have sex with me. I'm going to read, since the whole second half of the book is set in Tucson, I had this idea that I was going to prove how much I knew about your town. And then somewhere during dinner, I decided that that was probably silly and that you knew plenty about your town and you didn't need me to tell you. So instead, I've been reading 3 sections from the book recently that are quite short. And they have only, as a kind of binding agent, the fact that I think they're the best sections of the book. So the first is from the very beginning, which is to say the introduction by Montese Crandall, who's the narrator of the frame story in the book. So this is in his voice. People often ask me where I get my ideas. Or on one occasion back in 2024, I was asked, this was at a reading at an old-fashioned used media outlet right here in town, the store called Arachnids Incorporated. The audience consisted of 5 intrepid and stalwart folks, 4 out of the 5 no doubt intent on surfing aimlessly at consoles, or perhaps they intended to leave the store when instead they were herded into a cluster of uncomfortable petrochemical multi-use furniture modules by Noel Stroop, the hard-drinking owner-operator of the shop in question. I'd been pestering Noel about a reading for some time, months, despite the fact that Arachnids was not celebrated for its calendar of arts-related programming. To be honest, the reason for this pestering had most to do with my wife, who'd spend her remaining time on Earth counseling me on just how to boost my product. Ask Noel, my wife said, her eyes full of implacable purpose. We used to see Noel at the flea market, which by now took up more than a dozen city blocks. There were more flea markets than licensed tax-paying emporia in Rio Blanco. I had a booth there where on weekends I hawked old baseball cards and other sports memorabilia. This, therefore, is my business. It was here at the flea market, according to my wife's plans, that I screwed up my non-existent courage one Sunday and said to Noel Stroop, who is busy selling software modules, something called a compact disc, and ebook files, "Hey, Noel, what does a guy like me, a literary innovator, have to do in this town to get some respect?" Perhaps you're wondering what I've done to merit such a high opinion of my legacy. What is the nature of the Montese Crandall literary innovation? I'm going to take the remainder of this brief introduction to explicate fully my response to this question. Let me then throw down the gauntlet and remark that I, Montese Crandall, MFA, write very short, very condensed literary pieces, and by short, I mean very, very short. Shorter than you've probably read in your reading life, more than one word, usually, because one word is too easy, but quite a bit more modest than 50. The 350 pages of a novel, according to the argument I am wont to advance, are tedious elaboration. As I understand it, death, war, and adultery are the major novelistic themes, and these were all dispensed with well before Christ got nailed to his block of wood. the 19th century novel, you opine? Well, the 19th century novel does have it all. Attic-dwelling harridans, uncanny coincidences, advantageous marriages to strong, silent landowners, orphans, revolutions, wailing. You can't go wrong with the 19th century novel, but much that has been written since amounts to imitation, barely warmed over by writers with strange grammatical inclinations. Lovelorn women of Canada. Incest on the southern plantation. Drug-using editorial assistants. The usual stuff. Yours truly, Montese Crandall, living out his Pacific middle age in a college town next door over to nowhere at all, is unwilling to add more roughage to this rich diet. One thing the late 20th century was good at, besides mass marketing, paring away, omitting needless words, alluding without overstating. Dust bunny under radiator. Cockroach on window blind. Heartbreak in the food court. Impotence, subdivisions, melanoma, muffler problems. On the advent of the digital age, as you know, writers who went on and on just didn't last. You couldn't read all that nonsense on a screen. Fragmentation became the one true way. Fragmentation offered a point-and-click interface. Additionally, this strategic reduction blurred the line between poetry and prose, which is where I, Montese Crandall, come into the story. I, Montese Crandall, rely heavily on such strategies as alliteration, condensation, the strange ghostly echo of metrical feet, iambs and dactyls, spondees and amphibrax. For example, here's a pair of amphibrax, unstressed, stressed, unstressed, that might very well summarize my entire output. Romantic objective. The phrase does have a fine euphony. My first groundbreaking and innovative one-sentence story occurred in the following way. I'd been working on a 45-page erotic novella that was loosely based on my boundless physical desire for my wife, Tara Schott Crandall. The sequence in which I performed a certain advanced delight upon her delicately canted pelvis ran well over 20 pages, and her mews and snorts of transport, as described in the text, would pierce the waxy consciousnesses of neighbors up and down the block. Her cries of delight, as described therein, were likened to the coyote howling on the mesa, the kettle shrilling on the stovetop. Sopranos in local opera companies would hang their heads, for they knew that when Tara Schott Crandall climaxed, they were out of a job. I am afraid I cut the entire passage, the erotic part. And not only that, then I cut the opening and the ending. I cut a lot of the middle. I cut the part where we were post-coitally sharing a glass of Van Ordinaire. Next, I cut the astoundingly tender moment in the story where, in snappy dialogue, Tara and I revisited our assignations past. The time in the back of the minivan, the time in the woods when we got poison ivy, the time in the press box at the basketball game. For a while, a single scene remained in which the Tara character sent me out after lovemaking for eggs. Eggs. So beautiful. So fecund. Likely to balance on their oblong points during the equinoxes. Symbols of fertility. Available in multiple sizes, including jumbo. I couldn't let go of this scene for a while. You know how this is. And yet, after 3 months of wrestling with that story, I cut the entire tangle of misbegotten sentences, the whole sprawling mess, or almost all of it, leaving none at last but the following. Go get some eggs, you dwarf. I don't expect everyone reading this introduction to see immediately the merit in this sentence. And yet the awakening, the unfolding that occurred to me after a relaxed consideration of the 6 words that remained of this longer work, this unfolding located itself in the fact that the more I read and reread the sentence above, the better I liked it. I printed it out in various fonts. I pulled my few remaining hairs out, trying to decide whether to cut the word go. I pronounced the entirety of the story aloud to myself while walking from our ramshackle subdivision to the shipping offices, where I then occasionally pulled a shift. I would intone the sentence while going past the shuttered health and beauty aids purveyor on 22nd and Mountain. I would say it while taking my number at the woebegone post office on 6th. I shouted it at the beckoning doors of the gay bars on 4th Avenue. I said it to myself at the food co-op, as if the eggs in question were part of an actual shopping agenda. I can't tell you how long it took me, in my ecstatically creative state, to realize that, in fact, there needn't be an exclamation point at the end. My wife, whose health situation had taken a rather unsettling turn, never approved of the long version of the story, though she generally supported whatever wind blew me along in my compositional hobbies, as long as I took seriously the post-compositional portion of the writer's life and got out there to sell, sell, sell. She did, however, enjoy Go Get Some Eggs, You Dwarf, where, my wife inquired, was I going to publish this story? Was I going to pit against one another some nationally recognized periodicals? And what about book publication? Had I considered a run of hardcovers? In fact, I had secured an agreement with a little web periodical called Mud Hut, where my story got an entire page by itself. No title, no byline. Not 6 months later, fresh from the victory just described, I came up with what I like to think of as the second finest narrative I've ever composed. And yet, before I type out for you that magnificence, I should describe what I look like, because it bears on the interpretation of this second effort. I am, you should know, in my late 40s or thereabouts, and it is simply being honest to note that my metabolism, which was doing wind sprints and stomach crunches throughout the dark ages of my 20s, has lately taken an ill-advised nap. I am now the site of an unmistakable sag, as if some avalanche stirred at the crest of my solar plexus and sent all the flab in my northern latitudes down toward my once noble pubic swell. With fancy holographic belt buckles do I attempt to restrain this stampeding softness in vain. Additionally, my hair is thinning and my skin, which once had the virtue of being free from the blemishes that trouble the young, is now mottled and flaky. Burst blood vessels lead the eye of any observer astray around my nose. I am yoked to bifocals for my ocular needs. I have fallen arches, hammer toes. My only virtues as a physical specimen are my sideburns, which are like the pelts of rare woodland animals. My sideburns are not to be ignored. No one, let it be said, would mistake me for a pugilist, for a law and order type, for a person drawn to physical conflicts, for a militarist. I do not carry a taser or other weapon, loaded or unloaded, though this is legal and even encouraged in my state. However, I could easily write at least 5 pages about these sorts of weapons. The Gatling, the Armalite, the Glock, the Proton Disruptor, revealing a complex and deeply seated need for appurtenances of male power and phallic supremacy, even as I disdain these commonplaces in my everyday life and incline, in an era of Islamist saber-rattling, toward a foreign policy of tolerance and non-intervention. And yet, as you will have surmised at this point, the 5 pages of such a story would sooner or later be stripped of elaborations, adjectives, adverbs, similes, astute geopolitical views, until what remained was only, "We went with the stealth bomber." This was a sentence of such limpid beauty and durability that it was very difficult to follow up, notwithstanding an unprecedented second publication on the Mud Hut site. So affecting was the sentence, in fact, that there was a danger in having composed it, namely that I would retreat to the reliable paycheck of some day job, becoming, for example, an exclusive buyer and seller of baseball cards without composing again. I don't know how many months went by. During this time, my argument was simply, why bother? Have I not already proven myself? Have I not written a timeless epic from the front lines of the military-industrial complex, which, in the third decade of the new millennium, we now know to be not only a complex, but, more or less, the whole shebang? The answer was yes. There was no longer a need to prove my dominance in the writing field. In fact, what I craved instead, here at the top of my game, was domesticity. The ability to control a little narrow patch of scorpion and tarantula-infested dry land around a single-story house in a town where it never rained. Yet, professionalism being what it is, in due course, a suite of stories in the first person followed. Apparently, I could not stop. In general, I much prefer a narration from the third-person point of view. The first person is tiresome and confining. It is the voice of narcissists and borderline personalities. Still, my wife, whose problem was a respiratory problem, was getting worse. She was fast approaching her double lung transplant, and while it would have been easy just to wait until her name came up on the International Organ Lottery, while it would have been easy to collect the meager government funds dispersed to her as a citizen with a chronic genetic condition, I did, in fact, need some avenue of self-expression. Along came the idea for my masterful trilogy. If you like, if it helps you to understand the kinds of influences that resulted in the literary coming of age of Montes Crandall, you may think of these next 3 stories as related thematically to the 3-volume compositions of the 19th century, not unlike a doorstopper by a Thackeray or a Trollope. Well, on advice of counsel, and in order to avoid violating my own copyright with regard to a future collected works of Montes Crandall, now being discussed at one of the larger presses, I'm obligated to forego quotation of these works from the middle period. I'm sure you understand. Years had passed in my writerly biography, years of dreams and ambitions, years of seeing other, less equipped artists finding publication, even renown, in web publishing venues or even small press publication, while I had as yet only 5 publishable sentences, notwithstanding my education at a state school in the Northeast and a Master of Fine Arts degree from an online program in the Rust Belt. As a result, I was in no position to suppress my trilogy or to recall publication, which constituted a full 60% of my output. Not every work by a writer is his best, especially when he's preoccupied with more homely responsibilities, one of these being the resale of baseball cards obtained from the disgruntled mothers of the world, who, as you know, have forged an international conspiracy to throw out the baseball cards in order to drive up prices. My other activity consisted of lugging oxygen tanks around my house. There was also the vigorous pounding on the back of my wife, Tara, which was occasionally necessary in the mornings so that she could take advantage of life. I loved my wife. I comforted her when she needed comforting. My wife, understand, was going to die, and she knew it, and I knew it, and now you know it too. When the breeze blew up across the waterless tundra of my state, I often thought if only I could just harness some of that breeze and give it to Tara, our problems would be resolved. There are no sailboats in my part of the country that need the breezes. The jet pilots would be happy to encounter less clear air turbulence. The state officials have resisted wind farms at every turn. And the atmosphere that shrink wraps the globe offers a rich supply of oxygen. Why couldn't my wife have a bit of it in her bloodstream? What made her so undeserving? With this going on, you see, I sometimes didn't feel much like writing. So that's Montes. That's the beginning. Much later, there's a trip to Mars. And that's narrated by Jed Richards. And somewhere in the middle of it, while he's thinking about flesh-eating streptococcus, he has a reverie that is as follows. And somehow the situation on Earth reminds me of those last 300 whooping cranes, those birds that someone has been forcibly migrating back and forth from Florida for the past 20-odd years with the aid of an ultralight. This small population of birds is not a sustainable population, the experts all say, because with the right outbreak of avian flu, which we already know can knock out a couple million people in an overcrowded ecosystem, the entire whooping crane population could collapse. One germ and extinction follows. A beautiful thing, though, a whooping crane, and in the not-so-distant future, there will only be a couple of them left, and they'll have only one wing apiece, and they will idle on some lawn, like the lawn near Cape Canaveral. One of this non-mating pair will die of old age, and then there will be one last whooping crane, and it'll eat moldy popcorn from underneath the NASA reviewing stand, and it'll have delusional thoughts, mothballed memories in which it was part of a flock, and this flock followed an ultralight down to Brazil for the winter and then back again. What does our whooping crane think? The last whooping crane of planet Earth. It thinks that the currents of air are a marvel, and it conceives of them in colors, spectra, as we think of sunsets. Just so does the last whooping crane, despite the fact that only the one wing works, think of these air currents. It remembers treetops, which were like sofas to the whooping crane back when it still had two wings. It could land in any treetop and put its head under its wing. And the whooping crane remembers, or believes it remembers, certain kinds of fish that are particularly savory, and maybe a certain level of freshness in the matter of seafood is what a whooping crane most prizes. And it remembers mating because back when it was young, it was picky in the mating department. And like many whooping cranes, it was not, despite its lanky beauty, terribly kind to the girls. Moreover, there was always the danger of infighting among the whooping cranes, and this last crane remembers all of this, and because the crane cannot speak of it, the memories are that much more painful. And now, in his loneliness, there is no other bird who protects that past of cranes, that long history of the most beautiful bird in this part of the country. And so the only other account of these events, after those others fade, is the memory of the guy who flew the ultralight. A balding guy with a not very good sense of humor A guy who told the worst jokes, not that the whooping crane understood the jokes, but rather the whooping crane recognized the timbre of this man's voice, a kind of ragged baritone that shaded into the tenor range, but with outbreaks of alto when he got nervous. And this was the call of the ultralight, as far as the whooping crane is concerned, this guy's rather humorous voice. It was not the cry of the whooping crane, which is a majestic sound. It was the cry of some bald guy who never much expected to be piloting birds. He probably believed he'd have a career in civil aviation, or maybe he thought he'd be an astronaut or something. And in fact, this is what he decides to do, because the day comes when this pilot can no longer fly the ultralight, because there are not enough cranes anymore. There's only the one crane, and he is crushed. Well, come on. Everyone is crushed. Life crushes you. And this is just one more story to stomp up and down on your crushed heart. This balding fellow going to visit the last crane sometimes, over where he thinks the crane might still be living, in some cage for injured birds. And he and the crane recognize each other. Indeed, though they have no common language in which to speak of their recognition, there's no way for the crane to speak of the man as a man speaks of a crane, and it would all go fine if the man could speak in the tongue of cranes, but he can't. While he's visiting the crane, there is, in the distance, a liftoff, one of the last space shuttle missions, and you can see it from almost 20 miles away. The conditions are that favorable in South Florida that day, and the guy, the balding pilot, the one with the bad jokes and the not reliable timbre to his voice, thinks that maybe the only reasonable thing to pursue after the experience of flying the ultralight is the experience of going up into space as soon as he can. And he sits on a bench by the one-winged whooping crane for a while, and then he notices that he's talking to the whooping crane, and he's saying, "Well, I don't exactly want to leave you here like this. I can't really think of anything worse. And I have left some people behind in my life. Who hasn't? Even some people I loved. But none of that is as bad as thinking that I won't see you here again. And no one who comes to see you here will know what I know about you. And you won't recognize these people. Nothing could be worse. But still, a man has to move on sometimes, and I just can't stay here doing this. And so I'm wondering, would you think it was okay for me to go ahead and undertake to become an astronaut? Do you think that you could possibly give me your blessing?" He knows that the whooping crane can't answer him. That's obvious enough. But he feels he owes a reasonable explanation to the whooping crane, even more of an explanation than he owes his wife or his parents. And the crane can't see how bad the pilot feels, how broken up he is, when the man thinks that he won't be able to visit the crane again. When the crane is a thing of the past, when the crane is nothing more than the fertilizer for creatures to come, the pilot will only learn of it online, because he'll be off pursuing his ambition, flying his test missions, sleeping in the barracks, all so that he might get the hell off the planet that slew the whooping crane. So this last little section is it's very short, and like many things in the second half of the book, it's meant as a love letter to this place that you live. Night fell over the desert, and Monaco 37 streaked past again, and the stars were like the future perfect of an uncommon verb. Or the stars were the filaments of discarded human aspirations, or the stars in the night sky were the innumerable preschoolers of September afraid to climb onto the bus in order to have their liberty abridged. Or the stars in the night sky were like so many holes into which our heads were to be stuck. Or the stars in the night sky were the innumerable computations of some frail and overburdened supercomputer come to the logical end of its computations, where the stars in the night sky were the total sum of responsibilities, grievances, loves of a certain nation, listing to the end of empire, where the stars in the night sky were an example of every possible color in the spectrum of all colors, but the beauty of this spectrum was so overwhelming that an unaided eye could no longer discern it. Where the stars in the night sky were the number of words required to correctly describe the stars as a whole, or the stars in the night sky represented the number of times that a certain recalcitrant boy was reminded to observe the natural world, where the stars in the night sky were ghosts of all the dead, known and unknown to this boy and others, or the stars in the night sky were pocket lighters flicked on during the encore of the stadium rock show back when there were still pocket lighters and still rock shows, where the stars in the night sky were a painterly representation of the idea of insignificance, where the stars in the night sky were the manifest eruption of something from nothing, where the stars hinted at a conflagration happening on the other side of a wall of dark substances through which these tiny holes had been poked, where the stars in the night sky were a soup of possibility, a broth of what might have been and what might come to pass. The stars in the night sky were a grinding down of all the mineralia of planet Earth into infinitesimal grains, which grains were in turn bits of gas and debris cast off by the stars themselves. The stars in the night sky indicated the natural end of our 24-hour day, and that was why they were greeted with such astonishment and relief. The turning away of the sun was relief and impertinence. The stars in the night sky were the light show for the desert itself, a ratification of its disuse. The stars in the night sky could only be appreciated in silence. The stars in the night sky could only be experienced in motionlessness. The stars in the night sky had a cumulative effect, and the longer you looked at them, the more you wanted to, as if the stars were somehow addictive. The stars in the night sky were addictive, and when used improperly, they crowded out other activities, particularly social activities, unless these activities were organized around the night sky itself. The stars in the night sky cohered with certain harmonic principles, cycles per second, but they did not accord with musical principles that affirmed tonality, but rather a more random sequences of assonances and dissonances of such long duration that most human beings would perceive the musical principles of the stars as having a dull, endless sameness, a dissonant mercilessness. The stars in the night sky were prolics, show-offy, because they meant to make a mockery of the mathematical ideas of infinity just by being here. They were finite, but limitless. The stars in the night sky had to be seen in the desert, and eventually the desert lured out all stargazers, even people who were busy with many other things, special education, identity theft, the making of low-budget pornography films, day trading in Central Asian markets. They all found that when they saw the stars in the desert, they put aside childish things, and thus in the desert there was the very large array, and then the very, very large array, and then there was the international Sonoran array, which was so large that you had to fly from one end of the field of radio dishes to the other to bear witness to the entirety of the stargazing apparatus of the desert. Whole cities sprang up inside the international Sonoran array. It had a complex of universities and think tanks, mostly now concentrated on the other side of the border, since that was where the venture capital was located, where there was less fallout from the emigration problem. People came to the desert because the stars were in the desert, and the stars had yet to be corrupted by man, though man had managed to corrupt so much else, and there was no fee involved. In fact, the stars, it seemed, would crush a man in a scenic gravitational panorama before man would ever corrupt the stars, and that was why man mostly neglected them or attempted to surpass the stars, gauzing over the night sky with his sugary glaze in the pursuit of making the night sky less seductive and more like the screen of a monitor switched to the off position. Thanks a lot.